Well, good morning. We want to welcome you once again to Austin Bible Church. We are delighted to have you with us this morning. We recognize that we have a number of visitors with us today, and we appreciate that. Appreciate getting to know you a little bit, and welcome you to join with us throughout this morning, this evening, and all throughout the week to hear Dr. Fruchtenbaum in this entire conference. I was just thinking a moment ago about this introduction and how to introduce Arnold, and realized that I'm perhaps one of the worst individuals in this room to do so. In fact, there are others here. For example, the Carnegies, I understand, go back a little ways, a year or two, a couple years, decades even, and appreciate that. One of the first items that Arnold spotted, in fact, when he first walked in the little area over here was the portrait there with Pastor Glenn Carnegie. So, and others as well. And have gone back for some time. Some have even participated in the Camp Shoshanim and other tours even with Aerial Ministries and different things there. In any event, I will do the best introduction I can. Dr. Fruchtenbaum is the author of many books in my library. And that is a blessing, a true blessing. Some of the items are on display over here. I should also point out we have so many Libronix Logos Bible software users that one of the newer products that's available now for your Logos Bible software is the Aerial Ministries Collection. And you can purchase that, unlock that for your system, and have pretty much everything that's over there on the table. Most of that, if not all of that, is now available in the Logos Bible software format. I wanted to recommend that to those of you that use that software. Dr. Fruchtenbaum is the director of Aerial Ministries, a tremendous ministry to the Jewish people in terms of providing for them gospel information, the evangelism information to lead them to a saving knowledge of the Messiahship of Jesus Christ, as well as providing for some amazing depths of teaching. We've discussed a number of times from this ministry, from this pulpit, how many of the messianic organizations that are out there are have a gospel message, have a grace gospel message, but then the teaching that they follow up with is not exactly on track in terms of our approach to dispensations, in terms of our understanding of the categories of doctrine from the Word of God. And yet with Aerial Ministries, you have a consistent pre-tribulational, rapture, dispensational scheme that's very much in affinity with the teaching that we have here. And that, in my mind, places Aerial Ministries head and shoulders above everything else. Not to diminish the other organizations, but the scholarship is head and shoulders above everything else in the world today. And I don't mean that lightly. That is a very true statement. In fact, last week I received a call from the Chosen People Ministries, and they were hoping to schedule a Passover demonstration and a missionary report here in the church and so forth. And I mentioned to them that I said, well, as a matter of fact, this coming week we're blessed to have Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum, and just immediately the name triggered the praise and the reaction of thankfulness and recognition that we are in store for a very wealth of teaching this coming week, and I couldn't agree more. All right, we had one session already this morning, the introductory session, which covered the abodes of Satan and laid the groundwork for what follows, starting now with session number two. Dr. Fruchtenbaum.
Okay, if you will, find an outline, should be in your seat, and turn to page 3. In our first session during the first hour this morning, we laid the groundwork for the series. One of the things we noted is that throughout Jewish history, he's had this long, unending war against the Jews, as he sought to destroy the Jews at every opportunity. Now, in our second session this morning, we're going to focus on a period of time when the Satanic war against the Jews will reach as great a single extent that previously simply called the tribulation or great tribulation. And hence our specific topic is the Jews and the tribulation. Now, by way of introduction, let's begin by turning to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when He separated the children of men, He set the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. For Jehovah's portion is His people, Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. That God has an overall prophetic program, which we often subdivide into three distinct plans, because God has a plan for the church, He has a plan for the Gentile nations, He has a plan for Israel. Whether we speak of God's plan for the church, the nations, or Israel, all three of God's plans somehow focus upon His plan and program for the Jewish people. So Moses says that when God providentially laid down what become the borders of the various countries, that was somehow based upon the number of Jews to play a role in that nation's history. A point we made this morning, the first hour, was when God is called the Most High, it emphasizes God as the possessor of the heavens and the earth. And the possessor of this earth, He can subdivide the earth as He wills and give a portion of the earth to whatever nation or people or tribe He chooses. When He did so and providentially laid down what become the borders of the USA, for example, that was somehow based upon a number of Jews that play a role in American history. As verse 9 proclaims, Jehovah's portion is His people, and Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. Now in this hour, we're focusing on the period of the tribulation, which will fall upon the whole world in general, and in fact all people living on the earth at that point of time. Even God's purposes for the tribulation focuses specifically on His plan for Israel. And again, that's the reason for our specific topic is the Jews and the tribulation. I'll cover this eventually in four different areas. We'll first of all discuss the Jews and the purposes of the tribulation. Secondly, we'll discuss the Jews and the beginning of the tribulation, how they relate to the start of these 7 years. Thirdly, we'll discuss the Jews in the tribulation. Here we mean what happens to them during this period of time. Now, fourth study will be on the Jews and how they relate to the end or conclusion of the tribulation. As far as of those four points, we'll cover just three of these this morning, and we'll cover the last point on Tuesday, and that will deal with Armageddon. Let's go on then to the first area, capital B in your outline, the Jews and the purpose of tribulation. There are three major purposes why God is bringing these conditions in. Now, the first purpose applies to Jews and Gentiles equally, which is to bring an end to wickedness and wicked ones. To bring an end of wickedness and wicked ones. That applies to both Jews and Gentiles equally and goes beyond our specific point for this study. I won't be developing this point, but on your outline you have the two passages that give you that purpose, Isaiah chapter 13, verse 9, and Isaiah chapter 24, verses 19 and 20. As far as the second and third purpose, they do directly relate to God's program for Israel, and so we'll turn to, for the second purpose, to Revelation chapter 7. Revelation 7. The Matthew 24:14 passage on your notes points out where Jesus said that the gospel will be proclaimed to all nations throughout the whole world before the end comes. And the one statement He makes in Matthew 24:14 is now given a full chapter of exposition. In that, verses 1 through 8 spell out the means of the proclamation, while verses 9 through 17 deal with the results of it. As we said in the first hour, chapter 6 through 9 deal with the events of the first half of the tribulation, and so this second purpose to bring about a worldwide revival will occur in the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. Verse 1 says, after this I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea or upon any tree. And as another angel sent from the sun rising, having a seal of living God, he cried with a great voice to whom the four angels were given to hurt the earth and sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither trees, nor neither the sea, nor the trees, until we have sealed the sevens of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of them that were sealed, 144,000, sealed of every tribe of the children of Israel. Verse 5, 6, 7, 8 go on to list 12 tribes, repeating 12,000 from this tribe and 12,000 from that one. The grand total comes to 144,000 Jews. If you release these 144,000 Jews, the gospel will be proclaimed throughout the whole world before the end comes. Looking at this from a human perspective, if I wish to conduct a worldwide revival in a short period of time, like 3.5 years, I could not think of a better group of people to use for that purpose than Jewish people. Now, coming from me, that may not sound too objective. So let me see if I can defend it a bit. If you look at the world missionary situation in the, today, you will notice very rather quickly the vast majority of foreign missionaries come from the English-speaking world, and the major part of them come from the USA. And if you interview these missionaries to see how much time they spend in training before they could begin to proclaim the word in a different language, after going to a Bible school or seminary program, well, that will prepare them in this nation, not quite in another nation that speaks a different language, then I think in terms of 2 or 3 years of language study before they're comfortably proclaiming the word in a new tongue. Now, so the average American missionary in the foreign field has spent a minimum of 6 years before he's comfortably proclaiming the word in a new language. But these events occur in only 3.5 years, just that there's simply not that much time to play with, and that is where there is a distinctive advantage of using Jewish people. First of all, the Jewish people are scattered, dispersed throughout the world. As a result, all of the world's major languages and a great number of the world's minor languages are spoken by some Jews somewhere. Furthermore, most Jews outside the USA speak fluently at least 2 languages or more. I'm fluent in 2 languages, but both my parents spoke 5 languages. My father's already passed away. My mother works as a translator for the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles. If my mother ever became a believer, she could witness in 5 different tongues without first going to language school. I keep in mind the context shows that these Jews are getting from the 4 winds of the earth, and so it's not going to be all coming from Israel, from all parts of the earth, and speaking the multiplicity of languages. Also, the American Jew being an exception to the rule, most Jews around the world do receive a basic education in the Old Testament. They have some basic ideas about the content of the Old Testament. So after God removes the church from the earth, he will then proceed to save 144,000 Jews from around the world. They already speak the languages which are essential. They have a knowledge of the Old Testament. All they may need is, say, the 10 basic steps of a campus crusade for Christ. And very quickly they can begin to proclaim the word in a new way. And so within 3.5 years, they'll begin to proclaim the word throughout the world. As a result, the world will hear the gospel from these Jewish people, no matter where they happen to be. Now, one question always comes up that I probably should answer at this point is this. Some people have claimed there are 2 tribes missing here, the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Dan. The tribe of Ephraim is not really missing. If you look at verse 8, he mentions the tribe of Joseph. In the tribe of Joseph, the name Joseph is sometimes used for Manasseh, sometimes for Ephraim. Manasseh is mentioned in verse 6. The tribe of Joseph in verse 8 refers to the tribe of Ephraim. That tribe is not missing. But the tribe of Dan is missing, and people over the years have felt this need to come up with all kinds of guesses as to why the tribe of Dan is missing. Now again, so much revelation is based upon the Old Testament. There are more than 550 references back to the Old Testament. And that's the key to understand why certain things are done the way they are within this book. Now if you list all the tribes of Israel, you'll always end up with 13 names. While Jacob only had 12 sons, Joseph received the privilege of the firstborn, and he fathered 2 separate tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim. So if you make up all the tribal names, it ends up being 13 names, so it's always called the 12 tribes of Israel. Ephraim and Manasseh are viewed as half-tribes. Now, because of that situation, whenever they begin to list the 12 tribes of Israel, they always have to drop one name to maintain the symmetry of 12. So, for example, back in Deuteronomy chapter 33. Moses lists the 12 tribal blessings that he gives, but to maintain the symmetry of 12, he drops the name Simeon. You won't find Simeon mentioned among the tribes in Deuteronomy chapter 33. As I travel, people always ask me, why is Dan missing from Revelation? Nobody ever asked me, why is Simeon missing from the book of Deuteronomy? That indicates nobody reads Deuteronomy, everybody reads Revelation. That does not help Moses maintain his royalties at all. But to maintain the symmetry of 12, he had to drop the name. Ezekiel chapters 47 and 48 does a similar thing. As he said, and he points out the 12 tribal divisions of the land in the Messianic kingdom, to maintain the symmetry of 12, he leaves out Levi, putting Levi in a whole different category. It's the same explanation for chapter 7. The only reason Dan is missing is to maintain the symmetry of 12. But Ezekiel points out Dan will be in the Messianic kingdom. So again, by means of the 144,000 Jews, God will proclaim the gospel throughout the world. As many of us learned rather early in our ministry, it's one thing to proclaim the gospel, but the reception of it is quite another. And what will be the results of this proclamation? Verse 9. After these things, after what things? After 144,000 of verses 1 through 8, I saw and behold a great multitude which no man could number, out of every nation, of all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, arrayed in white robes and palms in their hands. Now skip down to verse 13. One of the elders answered, saying unto me, these are arrayed in the white robes, who are they and whence came they? And I said to him, Lord, my Lord, you know. He said to me, these are they that come out of the great tribulation, for they washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. What John sees next is myriads and myriads of Gentiles standing before the throne of God, Gentiles who have come out of every nation, every tribe, every language group. When the question is raised as to the identity of all these Gentiles, the answer is, these are the Gentiles who have come out as believers from the tribulation, for they washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. As a result of the preaching of 144,000 Jews, myriads of Gentiles will come to saving faith. And this will accomplish the second major purpose of the tribulation, to bring about a worldwide revival. Now this revival will be so extensive, with such a tremendous success rate, it will create a deep sense of envy on the part of every Baptist evangelist you ever have met or will meet. We may see local revivals in our day, you may even see national revivals in our day. One time the Bible speaks of worldwide revival is going to be conducted by these 144,000 Jews. Now for the third purpose, we'll turn to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12, capital C, point 3 on your outline. The third major purpose of the tribulation is to break in pieces the will of the holy people. To break in pieces the will of the holy people. Verse 5 of chapter 12. Now beginning in chapter 11 of this book, the prophet has been given a vision in which he can see what conditions would be like for his people, the Jewish people, during the time of the tribulation. And the vision that began back in chapter 11 continues into chapter 12, terminating with verse 4. Now in verse 5, a question will be raised as to just how long will these terrible days be allowed to continue. And when the answer is given, he'll give us the third purpose. Verse 5, then I, Daniel, looked and behold, there stood at the tomb, the one on the brink of the river on this side, the other on the brink of the river on that side. And one said to a man clothed in linen was above the waters of the river, how long will it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand that unto heaven, and swore in the story of never, that shall be for a time, times and a half. And now notice, and when they made an end of breaking in pieces the will of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. These terrible days must continue till finally the will is broken, until they turn away from trying to establish unrighteousness and seek the righteousness of God, which is the Messiah. Now, while verse 7 gives us the purpose, going back now to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20, Ezekiel tells us the means by which this third purpose will be accomplished. Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 33. Ezekiel 20 and verse 33. Begin at verse 34, rather. I'll bring you out from the peoples and will gather you out of the countries wherein you're scattered, with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, with wrath put out. I'll bring you into wilderness of the peoples, and there will I enter into judgment with you face to face. Like as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the woodland of Egypt, so will I enter judgment with you, says the Lord Jehovah. And I'll cause you to pass under the rod, and I'll bring you the bond of the covenant. I'll purge out from among your doubles and them that transgress against me. I'll bring them forth out a land where they sojourn, but they will not enter into the land of Israel. You shall know that I am Jehovah. In these verses, notice that God draws a simile with the Exodus. At the Exodus, under Moses, God brought the entire people of Israel out of Egypt and brought them into the peninsula of the Sinai area. And God's program for Israel and Sinai was to accomplish two things. First of all, they were to receive the Mosaic Law. Secondly, they were to build a tabernacle through which much of the law could then be maintained. And then with these two things accomplished, they were to press on and enter into the promised land itself. But because of a series of murmurings and rebellions against the revealed will of God, at a place called Kadesh Barnea, which is an oasis right on the border of the promised land, God entered into judgment with his people. And the judgment was that all those who came out of Egypt will have to continue wandering till 40 years pass. In the 40-year period, all who came out of Egypt will die out, except for two good spies and those below the age of 20. So 40 years later, there was a new nation, a nation that was born as freemen in the desert and not as slaves in Egypt, could enter land under Joshua. That historical frame of reference becomes the background for something future, but now he says he'll begin to regather his people from all parts of the world, the regard we've been seeing with the present Jewish state of Israel. But at some point, God once again entered into judgment with his people. And by means of the tribulation judgments, he says in verse 37, verse 38, the rebels will be purged out. In verse 37, those who survive are going to be brought into the bond of the covenant, into the bond of the new covenant. It'll be a new nation, a regenerate nation. They'll then be allowed to enter the land of Israel under King Messiah. But by means of the tribulation judgments, God is going to break the will to bring them to repentance. So we can redefine the third purpose to be as follows: to bring about Israel's national salvation, to bring about Israel's national regeneration. Insofar as the three major purposes of the tribulation, then, the second and third purpose directly relates to God's program for the Jewish people. Now, capital C, the second part of our study for this morning is how the Jews relate to the beginning or the start of the 7 years. We'll go to Daniel chapter 9 as our first of two passages. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, we are given Daniel's famous prophecy of the 77ths, the 490-year period God has decreed over the Jewish people. It goes beyond our purpose to go through the whole passage phrase by phrase. For those of us involved in Jewish ministries, as I am, it's one of the more important passages to know well, because it contains the only prophecy that gives us a timetable for the first coming. But as you work your way through it, what you learn is that by the time you come to the end of verse 26, the first 483 years of this 490-year period has already been fulfilled in history, coming to an end at the time of the first coming. But there's still 7 years left to run of this prophetic time clock over Israel, the same 7 years as those of the tribulation. Now the question is, what will be that one singular event that will begin the 7 years taking away, which brings us to verse 27 of Daniel chapter 9. And he shall make a firm covenant for many for 1 7. In the middle of the 7, he will cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And upon the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate. And even to a full end of that determined shall wrath be put out upon the desolate. The 7 years begin with one decisive event, which is the signing of a 7-year covenant between Israel and the Antichrist. It won't be, will not be the rapture as such that will begin the tribulation. I firmly believe the rapture occurs sometime the tribulation starts, maybe just before, maybe 10, 20, 30 years before, we simply don't know. The starting point of the tribulation is not the rapture, but the signing of this covenant. Until this covenant is signed, the tribulation cannot begin. The pronoun he goes back to his narrowest antecedent, which is found in verse 26 as, the prince that shall come. In other words, the prince that shall come in verse 26, and the he who makes a covenant in verse 27, is the one and the same individual, but no now circles simply as the Antichrist. Now, the tribulation begins with the signing of a 7-year covenant. This presupposes two things already in place. One is and one is not. First of all, this presupposes there is a Jewish state with a Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed, and that has been true as of 1948. Biblically, because the rapture was always imminent, the rapture could have come before 1948. But the tribulation could not come before 48. There was no Jewish state with a Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. The second this presupposes is that the Antichrist is already in high political authority with whom a sovereign state like Israel could sign a covenant of this nature, and that is not yet in place. Since I first became a believer, which was way back in 57, over the years people have asked me, does this person's name equal 666, or that person's name equal 666? That included people like Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon. One even suggested that Ronald Reagan must be the Antichrist because his first name, middle name, last name all had 6 letters to them, so he had just 666, as if God was using the Latin alphabet when he said these things. And I've been asked about Bill Clinton, is his name equal 666? My answer is, no, his name does not equal 666, but Hillary Clinton does. It doesn't really, I just threw that in. And the Antichrist will be a man, not a woman anyway. And all three other things which have become important for our studies on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. First of all, the covenant is made with many, but not with all. As we'll see in subsequent studies, there will be a segment of the Jewish people that refused anything to do with the covenant. The covenant is made with many. The many would have to include leadership of Israel and power to sign covenants of this nature, but will not be made with all. Secondly, although the covenant is made to last for 7 years, it won't make it through the 7-year period. At the halfway point, 3.5 years after it's made, it will be broken. And the breaking will be marked by a forced cessation of the sacrificial system. And thirdly, the result of breaking the covenant will be desolations falling upon the Jewish people. Now, this covenant is viewed by Daniel 9:27 is viewed from a human perspective. From a human viewpoint, it will be looked upon as a 7-year treaty that simply will not last as long as it was intended to. Our second passage, Isaiah chapter 28, will give us God's perspective on the covenant that triggers the tribulation. Isaiah chapter 28. First of all, in chapter 28, verse 14, we're given God's perspective on the many who make this covenant. He calls them scoffers or fools. That's because of his perspective on the covenant itself in verse 15, because you have said, we made a covenant with death, and which shall we in agreement, and when the overflowing skirt shall pass through, it will not come unto us. We may lies our refuge out, and under falsehood have we hidden ourselves. Now it's in verse 15 that we discover why they make such a covenant to begin with. Another point we made in our first hour this morning is that while the Bible does use many symbols, it is consistent in its usage of symbols. Any one symbol means the same thing to both testaments in about 95% of the cases. Whenever the figure of a flood is used symbolically, it always symbolizes a military invasion. We have that figure being used here in verse 15 with the overflowing scourge, the overflowing flood. Now, the word security is by far the most important single word in Israeli foreign policy. Israel has fought four major wars with the Arab states over the issue of Israeli security. The war against the PLO in Lebanon some years ago is over the issue of Israeli security. The bombing of the Iraqi nuclear reactors over the issue of Israeli security. And even the present negotiations, which keep coming and going, have to do with the issue of Israeli security. But situations will arise in the future that leadership will come to feel the only hope they have of gaining this security is by making this covenant with the Antichrist. There is a common misconception they will accept the Antichrist as the Messiah. The Bible nowhere teaches this. They will not accept him as the Messiah, but they will enter into a pact with him, a covenant with him, a treaty with him, that somehow guarantees Israel's security. They put their trust in this covenant. It now will trigger the tribulation. The same three things we saw happening in Daniel 9:27 we'll see happening here. First of all, in verse 16, we read of the non-many. They'll have nothing to do with the covenant. More about them later on in our studies on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Secondly, in Daniel 9:27, the covenant was broken. Same thing happens here in verse 18. Your covenant with death shall be annulled. Your agreement with Sheol will not stand, and when the overflowing skirt shall pass through, then you shall be trodden down by it. As in Daniel 9:27, so here, the covenant is broken, it is annulled, it will not last as long as was intended to. And in place of being exempt from any further military problems, they now become subject to it. Now, the third thing in Daniel 9:27 was the result of the breaking of the covenant will be desolations falling upon the Jewish people. The same thing happens here in verse 19. As often as it passes through, will take you by morning it shall pass through, by day and by night it shall be nothing but terror to understand the message. For the bed is shorter, the man can stretch himself out on it, the covenant narrowed, can wrap himself up in it. They made the covenant for reasons of security and comfort. Once it is annulled, they will have measures, strong measures of insecurity and discomfort. The picture of extreme discomfort is given two illustrations in verse 20. First of all, they're trying to stretch yourself out in the bed, but the bed is simply too short for you. Or secondly, trying to wrap yourself up in a blanket and give yourself protection from the cold, but the blanket is too small to cover all of you. Now, being a 5'4" Jewish kid, I've never had this first experience. I have no idea what it must feel like not to be able to stretch myself out in a bed. Every time I try to do so, I've done so admirably. Some problems you don't have when you're 5'4". Every 2 years or so, I've been leading these specialized study tours of Israel, which lasts for 5 weeks. And one of the participants that came back in 78 was a professional basketball player with the San Antonio Spurs. Just under 7 feet tall. The only Philistine ever came on one of my trips like this. And because in Israel they make beds for my size people, more than once at breakfast time he would complain to me about a very uncomfortable night because he could not stretch himself out in his bed. I had no way to identify myself with his trials and tribulations whatsoever. Some problems you don't have when you're 5'4". I remember having a second experience when I was still a student at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. It was in the month of January 1967, about 5 months before the Six-Day War. And those of us majoring in historical geography and archaeology were given some time off from classes to go down to the Negev Desert to do some archaeological experience. And this was before the Six-Day War. The old Judean border cut into the heartland of present-day Israel. And the area I was working was near the old border, so for reasons of security, we had to spend the night in the Israeli military encampment. And the blanket I was issued the first night was even too small for a 5 foot, 4 inch Jewish kid. That night, as I tried to keep my feet warm, my nose would freeze. When I warmed up my nose, my feet would get cold. And all night long, the story simply repeated itself. I would fall asleep, wake up, because that stupid blanket wouldn't cover all of me. A night of insecurity, a night of discomfort, which is the point of verse 20. Verse 21, for Jehovah rises up as in Mount Perazim, he'll be wroth in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. Now therefore be ye not scoffers, lest your bonds be made strong for him. A decree of destruction ever heard from the Lord, Jehovah of hosts, upon the whole earth. The Bible gives us many different names for what we now commonly call the tribulation. Here are two such names, Jehovah's strange work and Jehovah's strange act. It is a strange work and a strange act because of the closing phrase of verse 22. A decree of destruction ever heard from the Lord, Jehovah of hosts, upon the whole earth. Because when this covenant is signed here on earth, in heaven God issues this decree of destruction. And this decree of destruction is the same as the seven sealed scroll of chapters 5 and 6 in Revelation. And as these seals are broken, there will be a massive destruction of the earth's surface and a massive destruction of the earth's population. By the time the 7 years run their course, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the earth's surface is destroyed, and equal percentage of the earth's population. But God will issue this clear decree of destruction against all earth only as a result of the signing of the covenant. Insofar as the start of the tribulation, again, the tribulation cannot begin until the signing of a seven-year treaty between Israel and the Antichrist. Now, capital D, the third part of study for this morning, is how the Jews relate in the tribulation. At this point, the Bible has a lot to say. There are many scriptures that deal with this. For the sake of time, we'll limit ourselves to just the four passages you have listed, beginning with Jeremiah chapter 30. Jeremiah 30. Jeremiah 30, verse 4. Jeremiah 30, verse 4. Now these are the words that Jehovah spake concerning Israel, concerning Judah. For thus says Jehovah, heard of trembling, a voice of trembling and of fear, not of peace. Ask ye now and see what the man does travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man with hands and loins, as women travail, and all faces turned into paleness. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. As I mentioned a few moments ago, there are many different names for this period of time that will precede the establishment of the Messianic Kingdom. But here we're given a name which directly relates to the Jewish people. He calls it the time of Jacob's trouble. The time of Jacob's trouble. For while it is true everybody in the tribulation suffers, the Jewish people will suffer more so. And that's because of a principle found in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 1 and 2. Isaiah 40, verse 1 and 2, that teaches Israel sees double for her sins. When God punishes the Gentiles, they're punished this much. Israel is punished this much. And because Israel sees double for her sins, the tribulation becomes uniquely the time of Jacob's trouble. How much more they'll suffer, we'll see in the next three passages. Before leaving this one, note verse 7 does contain a promise. No matter how bad it might get for the Jewish people as a people will survive it. Second passage, Matthew 24. Matthew chapter 24, verse 15. When therefore you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let him that reads understand, then let them in Judea flee unto the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out the things in his house. Let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. For unto them that are with child, to them that are suck in those days, and pray that your flight be not a winter, be on a Sabbath, for then shall be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, nor ever shall be. Except those days have been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. For elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Now, verse 15, it gives a warning sign to Jewish people living at the midpoint of the tribulation in the city of Jerusalem in the land of Israel, that when they see the abomination of desolation, the same one we read in the book of Daniel he makes reference to, when they hear of this event taking place, they must get out of Israel and get out of Israel quickly. The abomination is when the Antichrist will break his seven-year covenant, take over the Jewish temple, see themselves in it, proclaim himself to be God Almighty, call upon the whole world to worship him as God, and to signify their acceptance of his deity by taking the mark of 666. When they hear of this event taking place, they must leave the land and do so quickly. There's not even a second to lose. So if you happen to be on the housetop for any reason, don't come off the roof and go inside the house to take any possessions. But as soon as your foot touches the door, make your way out of the country. If you're out in the field plowing and you hear this event taking place, don't go back to living quarters to take even as a coat. Just from where you are plowing, make your way out of the country. At this point, worldwide anti-Semitism breaks out in full force. And Satan's goal in his fifth abode that we discussed, the first hour, will now begin in earnest. In verse 20, two prayer requests are urged, that when this event occurs, prayer won't happen either on the Sabbath day or winter. Now, what might be the problem of winter, since it does not snow that much in Israel anyway? There are several differences between the United States and the State of Israel. One of these is the weather patterns. Here in North America, we're still receiving rain all four seasons. Rain falls here summer, fall, winter, and spring. Not so in Israel, which has a fixed rain season pattern. The rains begin to fall at mid-October. Rains fall in the months of November, December, January, and February, will begin to peter out in March and die out by mid-April. From mid-April to mid-October, no rain falls. Another difference is how highways are built. When Americans build a highway and come to a water gully, even if it's a dry water gully like we have here in Texas, the American way is to build a bridge across it. Not so in Israel, the roads were paved into these water gullies and up out again. Now, technically, these gullies are called wadis, W-A-D-I, a wadi. A wadi is dry all of summer. It's also dry most of winter. But during the winter rains, when rain falls on the mountains of Israel, water begins rushing down these wadis with tremendous force, carrying tons of rock and debris off and destroying these highways. But I was still living in Israel and driving around the country, there were times I would have to make a major detour because the wadi had destroyed the road just that way. Now, if Israelis like to hike these wadis, many of the picturesque look like many miniature Grand Canyons, often hiking into the fall months, not realizing the rain season had begun. It may not be raining where they happen to be hiking, but it's begun raining elsewhere. Like your two newspapers and one news magazine from Israel regularly, every fall the reports of Israelis killed that way. So this happens the winter months, it could make escape that much more difficult and dangerous. How dangerous it could be was made vivid a number of years ago when 40 French tourists were walking down a wadi, heading for an archaeological site. It was not raining where they were walking, but it began raining elsewhere. And once again, the rain started to come down. Within 30 minutes, 38 of the 40 French tourists drowned, only two survived. So he says, pray that your flight be not a winter. Second, pray won't happen the Sabbath day either. And why not in the Sabbath? On the Sabbath day, and it's all from sundown Friday till sundown Saturday, all public transportation closes down. No trains or buses are running. Unless you have an automobile, make escape that much more difficult. According to last census, about one-third of the Jewish public in Israel owns their own cars. Two-thirds are dependent upon public transportation, which is non-existent on the Sabbath day. So pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath. But the whole picture of this passage is this. At the midpoint of tribulation, the state collapses. There's one more forced exile from the land, primarily in the area of the Middle East. And exile will last for a short duration of 3.5 years, which will bring about the final determination. Now go to Revelation 12. Again, Revelation builds a lot on the Old Testament. Revelation 12 discusses the events that happened at the midpoint of the tribulation. But the first 5 verses provide with us a historical summary to explain why Satan has the special antagonism against the Jewish people. And in verses 1 and 2, he sees the vision of a woman arrayed with the sun, moon, and 12 stars. All of this brings us back to Joseph's dream in Genesis chapter 37, verses 9 through 11. Genesis 37, 9 through 11. From that passage, we learn the sun represents Jacob, the moon is Rachel, the 12 stars are the 12 sons of Jacob, who in turn father the 12 tribes of Israel. So this woman throughout this chapter represents the Jewish people, the people of Israel. Pictured as a woman because in the Old Testament, Israel was the wife of Jehovah. But in verse 1 and 2, at a certain point in history, just before the birth of the Messiah, just before the first coming. At this point in verse 3 and verse 4, Satan, using the access he has to the earth, brought his entire demonic army, demonic cohort, in around the land of Israel for the purpose of trying to thwart the purpose of the first coming. And the first attempt was made with the slaughter of the babes of Bethlehem. But throughout the life and ministry of Jesus, we find attempts to have him killed at the wrong time, before or after Passover, the wrong way, like by sword or by stoning. All such attempts fail with the statement, his hour was not yet come. If he had died at any other time than that Jewish Passover, in any other way than by crucifixion, there would have been no atonement. It was not merely the death of the Messiah that was essential for the atonement. Otherwise, he could have died as a 2-year-old in Bethlehem, and that would have been sufficient. But that would have been insufficient. His death had to come at the proper time and the proper way. Attempts are made to kill him at the wrong time and the wrong way. But eventually, he died at the proper time and the proper way. The atonement was made, and in verse 5, was caught up to God's throne when he ascended in the Mount of Olives. Some 5 verses were given a quick summary of the entire life of the Messiah from just before his birth until his ascension, covering some 35 to 37 years. And again, to show the background of why there's a special satanic animosity against the Jews, that's because they brought forward the Messiah destined to defeat Satan. But in verse 6, we find ourselves in the same place we're just at in Matthew 24. Verse 6, the woman fled in the wilderness, which her place be prayed of God, that they may nourish her 1,260 days. As in Daniel 9:20, as in Matthew 24, same thing happens here. The woman is fleeing. In Matthew 24, she fled to the mountains, but here to a wilderness or desert, to a place God's prepared in advance. There she hides for 1,260 days, equal to 2.5 years, the second half of the tribulation. All verse 6 says the woman is fleeing. It doesn't say why she is fleeing. That's explained by verses 7 through 12, the verses we detailed in the first hour this morning. At this point, Satan is cast out from his third abode down to his fourth abode. We noted earlier that once he's confined to the earth, he knows his time is short, 3.5 years before the second coming. As long as time is short, he is very angry. And notice how verses 13 and 14 bring together the thoughts found in verse 6 and verse 12. And when the dragon Satan was cast down to earth, he persecuted women that brought forth the man-child. and were given to the woman the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness unto a place where she's nourished for a time, and times and a half a time. As in the reason why she is fleeing is because Satan has begun the worldwide persecution of the Jewish people. Here again, I want to raise the question I raised in the first hour, the lens only on Monday night, and the question is this. What is the logic in Satan's mind between verse 12 and verse 13? In verse 12, once he's confined to the earth, he knows his time is short. And Nong is very angry. In verse 13, Nong his time is short, he inaugurates a worldwide persecution of the Jews. But why pick on the Jews just because your time is short? What is the logic in Satan's mind? We discuss on Monday the base of the second coming. We'll finally see the logic in Satan's mind. And again, the correlation between chapter 12 and chapter 13 is this. Chapter 12 outlines the satanic war against the Jews. Chapter 13 tells us about the two individuals he will use for that goal, the Antichrist in verses 1 through 10 and the false prophet in verse 11 through 18. Now, to what extent will he be successful? Let's go to Zechariah 13. Zechariah will be the second book from the back of your Old Testaments. The last prophet will be the Italian prophet, Malachi. Go past the Malachi papers, you'll find Zechariah. Chapter 13, verse 8. Chapter 13, verse 8. It shall come to pass that in all the land, says Jehovah, the two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein. Now bring the third part of fire, or find them as silver is defined, I will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, they shall say, Jehovah is my God. At what extent will he be successful? According to Zechariah, two-thirds of the Jewish population living at the time the covenant is signed will not survive those 7 years. One third is left, and they become our key concern for what's going to happen in the following studies. Under Nazism, one third of the Jewish population died, 17 were members of our family. But then under the Antichrist, two thirds will die, one third will survive to the end. The fourth part of our study has to do with how to relate to the end of tribulation, but again, that involves Armageddon. We'll devote the whole evening to that on Tuesday night. We're breaking it up with Monday night study on the basis of the second coming simply because of this. It's impossible to understand the whys and wherefores of Armageddon unless we first understand the one precondition that must be fulfilled before Messiah can return. So we'll cover that Monday night. One more thing for this morning, number 5, the four groups of Jews. During the 4 7 years, there'll be four different groups developing. The first group of the 144,000 Jews I mentioned earlier this morning, which has to do with those who evangelized the world in this period. The second group being called simply the apostate Jews. These will comprise approximately two-thirds of the Jewish population. They'll be the many who entered the covenant, and primarily these are the ones that will perish in the persecution of the second half. The third group we can call other Jewish believers. These are Jews who become believers throughout the 7 years, but now part of the 144,000 group. And the fourth group we call the faithful remnant. And they'll comprise approximately one-third of the Jewish population of that day. They go through the 7 years, unbelievers as far as the Messiah is concerned, but unbelievers as far as the Antichrist is concerned. These are the ones who will not go along with the covenant. These are ones that will succeed in escaping to the mountains of Matthew 24 and the desert of Revelation 12. And Armageddon will be organized specifically to try to wipe out this one-third Jewish remnant still living. And we'll see the circumstances in subsequent studies. But tonight we'll do a demonstration of the Messiah in the Passover. Again, let me remind you, there's a display table on my left side, your right side, if you want to order any of these books. You can do so while you go from an envelope there. That'll be available to you. And again, the book most relevant to the series of studies we're doing right now is called The Footsteps of the Messiah, Study of the Sequence of Prophetic Events. Otherwise, we'll continue with the study Monday.
We're going to be, the deacons will be coming forward then, and we'll be taking up the offering. Yes, go ahead and record, or pause the recording, or stop the recording.